Bill Myers was playing saxophone 60 years ago in traveling minstrel shows. He's been a musician all his life, but one day not long ago, he was rushed to the hospital. He thought he was dying.
That this is it for me. I'm 75 or 74 at the time. And the Lord said, I'll give you 70. I've had my 70. You know what I'm saying?
Bill Myers has also been writing music all his life. Most of it was in notebooks, not even recorded, and he made up his mind in the hospital that he would live long enough to do just that.
It's almost to me like my will, you know. My will is in place, and that's a part of my will, that your dad's been here and gone, but this is who he was.
Bill Myers did get that chance to record his songs and to say not who he was, but who he is. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
It was back in the spring on a stage in Wilson, North Carolina, when a group of jazz musicians led by Bill Myers and the Monitors took to the stage. It was a concert to celebrate 50 years of playing together. Among the musicians on stage were those who'd backed up artists like James Brown and Otis Redding. People in the audience that evening say it was a half-century musical celebration of a lifetime. Bill Myers is still shaking his head over making it happen.
50 years, and it kind of surprised us because we hadn't realized that we'd been doing that for 50 years until I went back. And I started looking at some pictures. And I said, my God, we were playing a junior senior prom in 1957. You know, that's 50 years, guys. That's 50 years.
The point is that the reunion almost didn't happen. And the recording of a lot of the music from that time also almost didn't happen. See, a couple of years ago, Bill Myers had some surgery on his right knee, and he was told that exercise would help with his recovery.
So I went to the gym, and I got on a stationary bicycle. And I'm rolling real slow. I mean, because I got to take this thing easy, real slow. But all of a sudden, I went into a cold sweat. And I got dizzy. I got disoriented. I said, something's happening to me. I got to get off this bicycle. I said, maybe I need some water. And the water fountain was on the other side of the room. And I tried to make my way to the water fountain. I never made it. Between the bicycle and the water fountain, I collapsed on the floor.
Were there other people there at the time?
And that was the good part about it. There were a lot of people there. But I was literally out. And all these people came running to me, and I could hear everything that they were saying, but I could not move. But I could hear everything they were saying. They thought I was dead, you know, and they were trying to rub my head. Oh, they were just doing everything trying to revive me. They were pumping my chest, you know, but I wasn't dead. Then I could hear them call the rescue squad, call his wife, call somebody, call everybody, you know. Get him some water.
And you couldn't say anything. You couldn't even lift a finger to signal that.
I could not speak. I was just incapacitated. But I could hear everything. It was funny because one lady said, take off his watch. And I'm saying, hey, man, that's a Rolex. You can't have my watch. That goes to my son. You can't do that. You can't. You know, I laugh about it now, but it wasn't funny at the time. They came in, and the rescue squad finally got there. But I'm still out. And they took, the lady said, his pressure is 60 over 40. And I'm laying there, hey, that's not good. I got to get off this floor. I got to get up. And so they got me on a stretcher. And when they got me outside, it was pouring down rain. And I'm outside, it's just raining. I said, would somebody put an umbrella over me or something? I'm getting soaked here, you know.
Again, you could still hear stuff?
I'm hearing everything that they're saying. I mean, but I just could not tell them that I could hear them. But luckily, the hospital was right around the corner. And they got me to the emergency room. My wife was in New York at the time, and she was on the train on the way back home. So I'm laying there in the hospital, and I remember the guy said, man, whatever you do, don't go to the light. Don't go to the light.
That's what the guy was saying.
No, I'm saying this to myself. Oh, don't go to the light. But I'm just completely out of it. And I'm laying there, Lord, this is it. I know I'm gone. This is it. And I could hear the doctors, and the doctors came in. And they sent me through some kind of machine and something like that. And I heard them say, he's got a massive blood clot in his right lung. I don't know how he's still alive. And I heard all of this, you know, pulmonary embolism, they were saying. And then they said, oh, here's another blood clot in the other lung. It's a smaller one. And here's a third one in his leg. I had three blood clots. And they said, I don't know how he's still living. And I'm laying there, so I guess this is it. And I'm thinking, all those things that I wanted to do, and now it's too late. I'm gone, you know. I said, I promised my wife I was going to take her to Hawaii. She's never been. She always wanted to go to Hawaii, and I never did that. I got all that music that I wrote, and nobody's ever heard it. They don't know where the key to the safety deposit. I'm thinking all of these things, you know, that's in my mind, you know, that I should have done, I should have taken care of, but I didn't do it. Well, they worked on me and worked on me and worked on me, the injections and injections, and they finally, well, make a long story short, I stayed in the hospital over a week, and I got better. And they kept feeding me. I'm on blood-thinning Coumadin medicine right now. As I do that.
Did you ever have a chance to say to the doctors, you know, I heard everything
I told them. I said, I heard everything you were saying. Oh, I definitely told them. I said, I heard everything you were saying. You know, so you got to be careful how you speak around people that you think in a coma, because many times they do hear you. They can't respond. But I heard you, you know.
Looking back on that, when you got out of the hospital, you had gone through this list of things you hadn't done. Mm-hmm. Did it give you the kind of impetus to say, I'm going to do some of these things?
Oh, definitely so. Definitely so. The first thing I did when I got out of the hospital, I booked the cruise to Hawaii with my wife. That's the very first thing I did. We did a cruise and had a wonderful, wonderful time.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Bill Myers and his wife, Diane, were delighted to get in that cruise to Hawaii, but Bill had more on his mind. He'd spent his entire life playing music and writing his own songs, but he'd never laid any of them down.
I said, I have to get some of my music recorded. I just have to do this. Good or bad, I just need someone to know that I wrote these songs, and they've just been sitting on the shelf or in a book at home.
But this got you looking back not only at the songs but also at the stories, right?
I mean, oh, yes. It was a time for reflection. You know, I said, I've been blessed. I've been given another chance. I don't know why I was given this second chance here, but whatever it is, I need to do something with it. I have truly been blessed here. So I went back. My wife had given me a home recording machine, and I sat in that room and just started playing. I just started playing. So I got to put these down. And one of my friends was in the backyard there, and she's a singer. And I said, Sherry, come and do me a favor, please. I need you to just sing these songs. I know we haven't rehearsed it like we should, but I'm not trying to sell these. I just want a record of what I've done. I want someone, my
like
kid.
Putting the family history down.
That's what
for
it
you,
was.
Wasn't
I said,
it?
I want my kids to know that I wrote this and this kind of thing like this. So she did that, and another friend of mine lived around the corner. I said, Gloria, come and please just sing these songs for me. We aren't going to have a lot of rehearsal. I'm not going to a studio. Everything we're going to do, I'm going to do the drums. I'm going to do the bass. I'm going to do the whole bit right here. I just want a record of what we've done.
What was the first song that you guys did? Do you remember?
Very first. Oh, yeah. The name of the song is All He Has to Do Is Love Me. People call it I Want a Man, like that. It was originally I Want a Woman when I wrote it.
You can change the lyrics.
I'd say whatever on that. I want a man who'll be good to me. And I want a man who'll treat me tenderly. But a strange thing happened with that. That song was written, oh my goodness, it had to be early 60s or something like that, you know. And when Gloria sang that song, she said, I really like this song, you know. And so I gave her a copy of the song. She, in turn, gave it to her minister, you know. And he said, I love this song, you know. And so he passed it to somebody else, to a lady at one of the local radio stations, WGTM, then in Wilson. And sure enough, she played it, you know.
On the air.
On the air. Man, and that blew me away because I had not heard my song on the air before. You know? And people started to call me and say, I really like that song. You know, I said, well, you know, this is good.
There's more.
There's more. You know, I got some more. You know, exactly. There's more.
All he has to do is love me. I'll love him.
Bill Myers found that going back through his old songs also took him back through the stories, back to his first days on stage in the minstrel shows of the 1940s, and on to his time in the Army in Korea, as well as the decades he spent as a public school teacher in eastern North Carolina. And we'll talk about that in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story.
When will I find him?
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. A couple of years ago, Bill Myers thought he was dying. He promised himself that if he ever got out of hospital, he'd go back to his old notebook, search out the songs that he'd written, and get them recorded. His earliest notes took him back to his childhood in eastern North Carolina in the 1940s, back when a young man like him with an interest in music had one reasonable option, and that was to play with the traveling minstrel shows.
The whole idea was of a minstrel show. It was like entertainment that would come once or twice a year. That was the Winstead Mighty Minstrels, Silas Greens. These were actors and dancers who would just go from community to community, put up a big tent in the field, almost like a circus coming to town. And they'd hire musicians. Well, someone told me that I could play, you know. So
you're playing the sax at the time,
I'm playing
right?
saxophone yeah. at the time, right. And so they hired me to play with them. And we'd get on the back of a truck and ride around through the city advertising the big show that was in town.
Like a circus parade
town. Yeah, you just go through town and play. And people would follow the truck, you know, and come down to where we were. And then we'd go outside and play to get people to come inside. It's like a big medicine show.
I was going to say, it's more like a revival meeting at this
Almost
point.
Almost like
right?
a revival meeting, but not religious.
Not a lot of
me. So we would go in and play for the dancers. Now, nothing is written. You have to be a good listener. And they would start a riff or something. You know, they would just start something. We have to pick it up and harmonize it. And that's what we did. And they would stay in town maybe 3 nights, then move to another community.
What kind of music were you guys playing at the time?
Oh, good songs. The people that were popular at that time were like Louis Jordan. I don't know if you remember Louis Jordan and his Timothy Five,
no.
Bull Moose Jackson.
What kind of song? Just hum or sing.
You know a song, Caledonia?
Caledonia?
Makes your big head so hard.
Walking with my baby, she got great big feet. She long, lean, and lank, and ain't had nothing to eat. But she's my baby, and I love her just the same. Crazy about that woman, 'cause Caledonia is her name. Caldonia! Caldonia! What make your big head so hot? Mom, I love you.
We would play it and just get the rhythm going, and the dancers would come out and dance to it, and they'd go back in, and then the comedians would come out and tell a few jokes, and the dancers would come back, and it's just a big show.
I want to ask you a little bit about what it was like back then, because we're talking the 1940s now.
Oh,
right,
yeah,
Bill?
We are. That's right.
We're
in the 40s.
No televisions.
This must have been
kind of a big deal when the minstrel show came.
It was a very big deal. That was like the only entertainment. So when the minstrel show would come to town, this was a big event, and it'd be a packed house.
Now, did you guys cross the color line here? Did you have whites coming to the minstrel show as well as blacks coming to the show?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
And would they come at the same time?
Come at the same time, but would sit in separate areas. There would be a roped-off area for whites and a roped-off area for blacks in there.
And what about the performers? All black performers?
All black performers,
so
yes.
None of these white performers in blackface, for example?
No. But some of the black performers in blackface.
Yes.
It is true. That's right. They would put on the black face and wear the big flappy shoes and the old clothes like a clown and something like that, to get some laughs. But yeah, that would happen.
It was for comedy, wasn't it?
It was definitely for comedy.
It's funny because we look back on the minstrel times now as a period of time where, you know, to have a white dressed in blackface and acting silly was kind of like a racist slur against blacks.
That came later. That came later. But at the time, it was just kind of taken for granted.
And it was not about the race. It was about the music.
It was about being funny. It was only after this, when the civil rights movement came about, that people looked at this. Those are racist things that you were doing back then. That was not good. But at the time, it was something that was a part of what we did. It was like my going to the drugstore. I can remember so clearly going to the drugstore, but I could not go to the front counter. I had to go to the end of the counter because that's where, quote, coloreds went. And it was only to somebody said, why do I have to do that? You know? And then it made us reflect about, we take another look at this thing. But at the time, it was what we did.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Bill Myers decided at a very young age that he wanted to be a musician. When it came time to pick a college, he chose Virginia State University because that's where his favorite band director had gone.
And I wanted to be just like him. He was my idol. Oh, man, I love this guy. I wanted to dress like him. I wanted to walk like him. I wanted to drive a car like everything that he did. That's why I wound up playing the saxophone, because he was a saxophone player. And he went to Virginia State. I said, well, I got to go to that school, too. I had never seen it. Didn't know where it was, but I knew I had to go to
that
school.
How far from home was it? Where had it been?
It's in Petersburg, Virginia.
So a good long bus ride, nothing more than that.
It was a good long bus ride, but it's just a bus ride, you know. So I got there, and I didn't have sense enough to get a cab to go over there. I saw a bus that had Virginia State on it, so I got on the bus. At that time, African-Americans had to sit in the back of the bus, and I had all this luggage and a footlocker and all this stuff. I'm in the back of the bus. But the bus went through Petersburg and had to pick up all these patrons and people who weren't waiting on the street. So by the time they got to Virginia State, the bus was packed. I mean, people were standing up. But I'm sitting in the back of the bus. So when he gets down to the Virginia State, he says, all off for Virginia State. So all these people have to get off the bus so I can get my stuff on. And they were calling me all kinds of names as I come down. Well, she'd gone on, you know, this kind of thing on the bus. But when I got there, Virginia State's on a tall hill. It's far above the Appomattox River. And I'm down at the foot of the hill with a footlocker and suitcases and stuff. Now I got to drag all this stuff up this tremendous hill. So when I get there, people are like, man, where'd you come from? Didn't you know you should have gotten a cab or something over here? You must be straight out in the woods or someplace coming up here.
And you arrived with... with a musical instrument or no?
No, I did not have a musical instrument. And that was something else that they thought was the strangest thing in the world, because here I was there to be a music major with no instrument. And so the professor said, well, where's your instrument? I said, I don't have one. What? You mean you've come to be a music major? And so what do you play? I said, well, I play the saxophone. You don't own one? No, sir, I sure don't. And he said, well, we got to do something about that. So they gave me a job. And my job was to clean up the basement where the football players changed Now, that was a messy job.
The locker room?
The locker room.
Yuck.
Oh, that's exactly yuck. I mean, the tape everywhere, mud, you just name it, it was in the – and then my job was to clean that room. And I did it. I did it religiously every day. And finally, we raised enough money with me and my dad, $257 to buy a saxophone. At that time,
that's a lot of money.
At that time, it was a great deal of money.
Yeah.
It was a lot of money then.
How long did you have to work in that locker room to raise that kind
of
money?
I worked all that year and part of the next year into my sophomore year. Then I started to get gigs, as they would call them. So I would play every weekend so much that they nicknamed me Gig Master. And so between my playing and what my parents could do, I worked my way through college.
Is there a song that takes you back to that time? Is there one that you would use to mark that time?
Yeah. That was this girl. Her name was Paula. And I thought Paula was the prettiest thing in the world. So everybody on campus knew Paula, you know. So I wrote a song for Paula. Now, Paula never turned her head to look at me. She didn't know who I was from the tree, you know. But, man, everybody loved Paula.
What was the name of the song?
Paula.
And did you sing it for her, play
Oh,
it for
you
her?
Better believe I did. Yes, we did. A friend of mine, my roommate at the time, wrote the words for the song Paula. So listen, we grabbed Paula and said, listen, Paula, come on over, go to the practice room with us. We want you to hear something. You know? So we took her over to the place, and this is a song we wrote just for you. She loved it. You know.
Did you get a date out of it?
No, never did. She still never looked back at me.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. After he got out of college, Bill Myers did time with the Army in Korea. And when he came home, he was once again determined to do anything he could to become a full-time musician. But his father persuaded him to interview for a job closer to home as a school teacher in Elm City, North Carolina.
So I went over there, and the man liked me and hired me right on the spot.
Now, why did you even go? I thought you had your heart set on...
Well, it was my dad wanted me to go see, but he said, just go see. Just go over and see about this. And it was a decision. I said, all right. They literally begged me to stay home, said, you've been gone 2 years. Why don't you just stay around a little bit, you know? I said, all right, I'm going to do this for 1 year to satisfy my parents. 1 year, I'm going to stay in this teaching thing and stay here in North Carolina. But after 1 year, I'm out of here to pursue my dreams, you know. But I got to Elm City, and I got caught up in that. Here were kids who had just not been exposed to a great deal. Here I had been around the world, basically, and I'd seen all these things and played all these places. But there were kids who were just starving for attention, who needed someone to say there's more to life than being here. Not that farming was bad. I never said that to them. But I wanted them to know there was something else, you know, out here.
I would bet a lot of these kids hadn't been very far away from the farm.
Some had never been out of Elm City. Believe it or not, some had never been to Raleigh, had never seen the capital of our state, had never seen the ocean, had never been in a movie theater. And that's what I found there. And I was so dismayed by this. So I started doing little things. I started taking field trips and getting them in my car and just taking them out. I took them to the ice capades. They'd never seen anybody skate on ice.
Yeah, tell me about that. Where did you get the idea?
Well, the ice capades were coming to Raleigh, right here in Raleigh. So I said, listen, I talked to the parents. I get as many as I can in my car, and I want you to go because the ice capades are beautiful. I mean, it's like a ballet on ice. And I know you'll love this. So I got, six or seven of them jammed into the car, and we went to see the ice capades. Oh, they were so thrilled by this. Never seen anything like this before.
Never seen ice.
Never seen it. Never seen a lot of people on roller skates because they couldn't roller skate on dirt roads in the country and things like that. But this was an eye-opening experience for them. And I saw the eyes just light up like, boy, that was tremendous, you know. And if you can see that light coming on the kid's eyes, it kind of rekindles your flames.
I was going to say, this sounds like a bit of a changing experience for you, too.
Here's a changing experience for me. I did something for this kid, you know, and that just excited me. And there were other experiences the same way. I took him to see the ocean. I took him down to see the Atlantic Ocean. You know, when kids say, is that it? You know, see, yeah, that's it. There it is. That's the ocean. That's the second largest ocean in the world. There it is right there, you know. Stick your foot in there, things like that. But just like I said, to see them light up, like that, and that I was providing that experience for him. I got caught up into that. And so I
enough
not only
to keep you enough to keep you enough from to returning to your love
there,
of music.
Enough to keep me right there. It was like I had been sent there for that purpose to do something for a few kids.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Naturally, Bill Myers taught music, and he was committed to opening his kids' mind to music that offered some variety from the gospel music that they heard all the time on the radio and at church.
One particular day, we were talking about jazz, and I talked about the beginnings of jazz. I said, now, jazz is an American music. This music was born right here in the United States. It all came from what you and I are calling Negro spirituals. It all came out of this period. And I would play the spirituals and show them how the music evolved from spirituals into blues, into jazz, and write up this musical tree and all these things. So one particular day, I was talking about beginnings of a music that was called bebop. And I was explaining how bebop was kind of an intricate form of jazz and things that Duke Ellington and Count Basie had been doing. But here some other people had made some different variations on this same music. And one of the names was a man named Charlie Parker, who played alto saxophone. Well, I'm explaining all this. I said, this other guy, I know you've seen him, you know, because he plays this trumpet that the bell sticks up in the air. It's not made like a regular trumpet. And every time he plays, his jaws go out real fat like this, you know. And I said, does anybody know who this guy is? Nobody knew. I said, well, now his initials are D.G. You know, does that ring a bell? We're getting closer now. Come on, think about it. He has his horn that's pointed in there. His jaws poke out. He wears a French beret. He has bebop glasses. Come on, now, his initials are D.G. Does anybody know about this? So finally, one little girl raised her hand. I got it, Mr. Myers. I got it. I said, come on, what's his name? She said, Daddy Grace. I said, no. We're talking about Dizzy Gillespie here, you know. To do a thing, I made up a thing called call sheets. And what I did with a call sheet was to have them to listen, because I found out that when people listen, sometimes they're only hearing what I call the upper surface. They're not hearing what's happening in the background. And so I had them to write down when the music would change. If you hear something different happen in the music, write it down and tell me what you hear. And that became quite popular. They would write it down and say, Miss Mike, I heard the timpani come in right there. Hey, that's good. You know, someone says, aren't those the flutes coming in? Yay, now you're listening. There's a difference between hearing and listening to this. So I wanted to get their ears in tune more into what was happening inside the music rather than just maybe what the vocalist was saying on top. I can remember trying to introduce opera to them. Opera was a bad word. Opera was something that only sophisticated and high-class people listened to.
Well, and it was foreign, too.
It was very foreign. That country folks, quote, didn't listen to opera. Where y'all get that from? Look at where you get that mess from. Opera's for everybody. So we wrote an opera. We did an opera right there in the school. We wrote the lyrics. We're gonna make instruments. We're gonna make some drums. We're gonna do all this thing. You're gonna play them. And I talked about the libretto and the overture and all those things that go into the making and the arias and all those things. So I said, these are parts of the opera that you need to be a part of. You might not understand a word that they're saying, but you need to know the story. So I got a chance to take some of them to see Madame Butterfly right at that Memorial Auditorium in Raleigh. Now, Madame Butterfly was done in Italian at the time when we got there. Not a word. I don't speak Italian. They didn't know what to say, but they knew the story about this girl who fell in love with this GI who went back to the United States and forgot his lover and ended that. And she was, you know the story. Madame Butterfly.
So did they like it?
Loved it. Loved it. Loved it. Huh.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Bill Myers devoted 40 years to teaching. He became a principal, eventually a school administrator, but he never gave up on music. His band, The Monitors, recently celebrated its 50th anniversary, and Bill is continuing to get his own songs, his own family legacy, recorded. We'll talk more and hear some more music in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Bill Myers is a musician in Wilson, North Carolina, but more than that, he's band leader of The Monitors, a jazz band with a history that has put him in touch with a number of well-known musicians. For example, long before she was famous, Roberta Flack was a singer with Bill Myers' band.
The thrill is gone. The thrill is gone away.
When I first heard Roberta Flack, I was really not all that impressed.
Get out of town.
I'm serious. Roberta was a tremendous musician, a great piano player. Many people don't know how well she plays piano. She's just really a great pianist.
But she's all pipes to me. Didn't even know she played an instrument.
Well, yeah, but see, what would happen, Roberta was like constantly at the piano and constantly singing. Even when we would take intermission, she would not take a break. She would sit at the piano and sing during intermission while we're out getting a Coke or something. She's up there. I said, that girl never gets tired, does she? You know? But it was the kind of thing that she wasn't as famous as she later became.
Yeah.
But she was just a kind of an ordinary singer.
So what changed for her in your
mind? Well, she left town. That's what happened. She got out of town. She was teaching in Farmville, North Carolina. And, the way things would happen, Farmville's a very small town. And we were living in Wilson. Well, she was the only female in the group. And she was a school teacher there in Farmville. And as we would go by to pick her up, say maybe 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, we wouldn't bring her back home until maybe 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. Well, that's not good for a school teacher's image, you know. So people would see, oh, my goodness, that school teacher's hanging out with those old musicians. And, you know, people began to talk about that. And so it wasn't good for her.
Bill Myers stayed in Wilson, North Carolina, near where he grew up. He was highly praised for his work as a public school teacher, but he never let go of the music that's been the longest-running story in his life. One day, he realized that his band had reached an important milestone.
50 years. And it kind of surprised us because we hadn't realized that we'd been doing that for 50 years until I went back and I started looking at some pictures. And I said, my God, we were playing a junior senior prom in 1957. You know, that's 50 years, guys. That's 50 years.
And all the members of the band are still with you? Or
no, I'm
them?
The only original one that's still there. Okay. Some are still alive, but I'm the only one that's still playing with the band.
Right.
Yeah. And I said, we need to celebrate this. And so that's what we decided to do. We booked a theater in Wilson, the Boykin Center, and went from there to do our concert. And it was very successful, more so than I dreamed. I mean, the house was packed, and I didn't envision that. You know, I thought we'd have a few of our friends who'd come out, but never conceived I'd do that. The place would be packed. People literally dancing in the aisles and just having a ball, and it was just great.
What did that tell you about the way that the Monitors, your music, has now become a part of your hometown? I mean, really, it must have made you think about that.
There's an aspect of this that I think is important. Music has changed so much over the years, and you always have some second thoughts, I guess. Do people still want to hear what we're playing? Because we're playing what people call old school, And some of the kids, you know, who into the hip-hop movement think that old school is very antiquated and things like that. So you have a concern about, will people still come to hear this? So when I saw the house that was there, and I heard the applause and the standing ovations that we got, I said, hey, this music is still alive. I like this. I love this. You know? And so it just gave us some encouragement to say, we must be doing something right. So when somebody comes back and wants to hear something that we have played, I get really excited about that. I mean, that just...
So tell me about, after the concert, did you sort of all look at each other and go, well, it's been a good 50 years, we're done, or are you still at it now?
We're definitely still at it. We're definitely still at it. A good thing came with the concert. Well, several good things came with the concert. There was a doctor in the audience, and he heard us. He has always been trying to promote his daughter, who's a student at Elon College here. He said, well, I want to see if I can hire these guys to be the backup band for her debut concert. So we're doing that on June 22nd of this year. He's already booked the auditorium, the same auditorium we did the concert. We've been rehearsing with her. When she came to my home, I said, we need to, first of all, decide on what you're going to do. Let's get our repertoire listed and get those things not lined up. And she said, the first song she said I want to sing, she said, I want to sing Embraceable You. Well, man, that knocked me in the floor. This 20-year-old lady wants to sing Embraceable You. Embraceable You is, you know, five times older than she is.
You know, so. It's not an easy song to sing.
Well, it's
either.
Not an easy song to sing, but it's an old song, you
yeah.
know.
Yeah.
And a song that I might relate to, but this song was like from the 40s or the 30s, and I'm thinking, how does this girl know this song, you know?
Embrace me, my sweet, embraceable you.
And I'm saying, hey, this is good. I said, how do you know that song? She says, I've been singing this all my life. My mother sings them around the house, and I've been knowing these songs since I've been a child. And this is what I want to do on my first concert.
Just one look at you, my heart grew tipsy.
As we heard earlier, Bill Myers nearly died 2 years ago. He thought about all the notebooks of songs he'd written throughout his life and never recorded. So when he got out of the hospital, Bill went back to those old books and found 50 years of stories told in song.
I wrote one for my daughter when she turned 16. And I'd forgotten it, to be quite honest with you, because I wrote another song for her when she got married. My son always fusses at me and said, Dad, you never wrote me a song, you know. I said, I have to write you a song. He's 44 years old right now, and he's still complaining.
He's still waiting.
And he's still waiting for his song. You didn't write me a song, you know. So I wrote some songs when my grandkids were born, things like that, because I was inspired, and I wanted to do something, you know.
It's got to come from somewhere personal.
Yeah, it has
to. I find. I mean, even in sitting in this chair and talking to the people who come through this radio studio, the best stories are the personal ones. Those are the ones that matter to people, you know?
Matters a great deal. It matters a great deal because they come from the heart. And I've gotten to the place where because they were personal and they were me and they were from me, that I don't care if anybody likes them or not. You know, it's like it's something that I did and I was sincere about it when I did it. And it was something that I wanted to do. And when I sit down sometimes to the piano and my heart just pours out with something and I have to put it down, I have to write it, I got to do it. And after I do it, I said, boy, that's all right. I finished that.
Now, there was a time when if you couldn't sell that song, you'd be discouraged.
Yeah, exactly.
Are you past that?
I'm way past that. Oh, I'm so far past that. I am way past that. I don't even care if somebody likes it or not. I was really after it one time trying to. I just wanted a song published. I said, boy, that would make my life if I could just get a song published, you know. And so I used to send off these songs. I was a waiter down at Virginia Beach, and the owners of the hotel found I could play the piano a little bit. So every Friday they'd have me go down and kind of play for the hotel guests. And so I'd play some of my own music while I'm playing, you know. So one lady came up to me, and she had a sister who worked for Columbia Records. She said, "Did you write that song?" I said, "Yes, you know." She says, "Here, I want you to send this to my sister." She gave me it and everything, you know. Man, I got so excited about that thing. I had never put it down on paper. I sat down out there and wrote it out as neatly as I can. I mean, this, you're talking about some penmanship? Oh, man, I wrote it out as neatly as I can write something.
How long before I love again? How long before I live?
I got it in the mail, and I went to the mailbox every day to see if I got some response. A year passed, and I never heard a thing. A year and a half, I never heard a thing. You know, finally, one day it comes back, "Mr. Myers, we received your music like this, and regretfully, we have to tell you, it's not in keeping with the current market." Or so it's one of those form letters you get, you know, and I was just kind of undone by that, you know, but I would keep trying.
Did you record that song, though? Is that one
of
the ones
that
you...
Yeah, it's on my CD. It's on there.
I've tried a million times or more, but things just aren't quite the same. I want my love like I had before. Won't someone tell me?
How long?
There's a story behind the writing of that song, How Long. Isn't there a love song, one of your own?
Yeah, there's a story behind How Long. I guess I had my eyes open. I was doing my student teaching in Norfolk, Virginia, and I had this girlfriend I'd been dating since high school. She was across the bay there in Newport News. I didn't realize how important a day Valentine's Day was to females. I mean, to me, Valentine's Day was just another day, but I learned that Valentine's Day is very special to females. Now, this is a long time ago. Believe me, I know it now. And
how did you find out?
Oh, man, it was one of those things where I had worked so hard to give her a Christmas present. I mean, I sold automobile tires, old pieces of rubber, to buy her a Christmas present, but I was broke. I mean, I was busted. And when Valentine's Day came, I had no money. And so I didn't send a card, I didn't call, I didn't do anything, you know. And so she got real upset about that, really upset about that, that I didn't do anything. And that started our breakup. That started it right there. And when I graduated later that year, I went to the Army and went straight to Korea. Well, while I'm in Korea, she starts dating another guy and just literally puts me down, like, "Jody's got your girl and gone," that kind of thing. And so I'm in Korea receiving no love letters as the other GIs were doing. I got no mail from this special girl. And it's a very lonesome time for me. I wanted some mail like everybody else. And so when I came back, I had no girlfriend. And I was not in love with anybody. And I enjoyed that period of being in love, you know, and having a special person. But I had no one. And I was literally looking for somebody, you know. And so this song just came. How long before I find this person? How long before I meet someone like I had before? How long before I have another friend? How long? Where can she be? How long? How long? How long? So I got to write this down.
That is from the heart.
That is from the heart. Believe me, it was from the heart. So that's what I wrote. I wrote How Long, and that's the name of that song.
How long
yeah.
before I love again?
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Bill Myers says he learned long ago that his songs are the record of his life, but his need to get them recorded runs deeper than that.
It means that my kids, my family, has something to remember me by. It's almost a legacy. And I poured a lot of myself into those songs. It doesn't mean you have to like them, you know. It just means that I wrote them, and I wanted someone to know that I wrote them. That's all. My aim was just to put them down. I'm laying in a hospital thinking this is my last breath. Literally, I mean, that's where I was. That this is it for me. I'm 75 or 74 at the time. And the Lord said, I'll give you 70. I've had my 70, you know what I'm saying? And so I just wanted them down, that's all. You know, whether they do anything with them or not, or whether anybody does anything with them, I just wanted them in place. It's almost to me like my will, you know. My will is in place, and that's a part of my will, that your dad's been here and gone, but this is who he was. He felt this way at this time. He did this. He did this. I just wanted to put him down, and that was purely my aim.
Bill Myers lives in Wilson, North Carolina. His band is called The Monitors. Special thanks today to the North Carolina Arts Council. You're listening to a tune called Bill's Theme, and it's from one of Bill's albums. That album is called My World. Find out more about Bill's music by visiting our website at thestory.org and following the links there. The story is produced by Anita Woodley, Corey Princell, and Rachel McCarthy, with help from Sheila Reed and Christina Smith. Kelsey Custer and Shiley Warren are our interns. Our engineers are Al Wadarski and Peter Bombar. Carol Jackson is the managing editor of The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.